And then yesterday morning, she's like, well, we'll just Skype in. But then she started to run a fever last night and is still running a fever this morning. So one of those deals where it's like, just lay low. So you get me instead. So.
Well, we're happy to have you. Thank you so much. I thought we'd start off, just I would ask David to kind of give you a little bit of information about his background, maybe where you grew up, where you went to school, how you and Abby met, maybe how you got into the ministry.
Yeah, so I grew up in the Northeast, so I'm a Northeasterner from Connecticut, right outside of Hartford. So Abby, if you know that area, Abby grew up in West Hartford. I grew up in Simsbury. My parents became Christians when I was a kid, and so that pretty radically reoriented my family. That's a long, wonderful story in itself, but basically through simple neighborhood evangelism and sustained relationship building, my parents became Christians. So, and actually, Abby's parents became Christians as adults as well. And so the evangelical community in Connecticut is pretty small, and so we went to adjacent churches, but we had a lot of kind of like overlaps with each other. The first time I met Abby was actually at a Christian summer camp called Lakeside Christian Camp in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, the summer after our freshman year of high school. Thought she was really cute, but, you know, went back to normal living and would see her occasionally at, you know, a birthday party for a friend that we both knew here, you know, whatever it might be. And then in college, I was back from my halfway through my junior year and went to this New Year's party with a bunch of other young adults back in the area and ran back into Abby. And we were in the basement of this house, and I remember her walking down the stairs and going, she's even cuter than she was in high school. And so got talking and ended up leaving the night pretty early. I'm like a grandpa. I'm early to bed. So left somewhere probably like 10:30 or something, 11 maybe, if I was feeling it. Just left, and she's like, I can't believe he didn't even ask me for my number. Like, we've been talking the whole night. And so she gave me one more chance. So I was putting on my winter coat, my boots upstairs, and she came back upstairs and was pretending to do something, totally giving me the opportunity to actually get her number, and I did. And so we dated for about a year, she's the first woman that I ever fell in love with. And broke up after about a year, and both of us were crushed, and it was a pretty rough breakup. She broke up with me, and so I was totally dejected, and then she tried to get back together with me, and I didn't feel like I could trust her, so I said no. So both of us like left being like the other person, the other person said no to me, and so we got back together a few years later, and those first few months of getting back together was just like learning to trust one another again. And both of us being like, all right, when are you going to be tired of this? I got back together. She moved, her plan was to move to Raleigh, North Carolina, where her brother and his family are. I got the Carolina fever and followed her a few months after. And proposed shortly after that. And then in all of that time, I did my undergrad at Taylor University, small little school in the cornfields of Indiana. And it was during my freshman year that I felt the call, both internally and externally, from people who knew me, say, you should really consider going into sort of a full-time vocational ministry form as a pastor. And so I wrestled through that and prayed about that, and it was really confirmed very clearly. And so switched my major. I thought my parents were going to be like, absolutely not, when I told them that I wanted to be a Bible and Christian ministry major, because my parents were helping me through college. We were having a split in there, but my parents supported it from day one, and that just meant the world. To call my dad and my mom and be like, this is what I'm feeling, and wondering if they were going to support that. And they were just gung-ho about it. So that meant a lot. And then after college, taught Bible at a Christian school in Connecticut for a few years. cut my teeth with middle schoolers and high schoolers. It was a great opportunity. I mean, day after day, I'm just teaching the Bible. And just to get those reps over and over and over again with students that wanted nothing to do with me there's harder experiences out there, but that was a trial by fire of like, you know, you walk into a room during like a chapel and you've got 120 high schoolers just looking at you like, what? And there's some resilience that I was able to build up in those 2 years. But I knew I wanted to serve the local church if the Lord would have that for me in a full-time capacity. So went to seminary after that, did a one-year residency at a church in Charlotte after that, and then came up here.
Thanks. So was Abby planning to be a pastor's wife? How did she adjust to that?
No, not at all. Not at all. But this is one of those things that's like, did it really happen like this, or is this just pastor's talk? And no, it really did happen like this, where both times that we dated, I had to have a conversation with her you do realize that I want to be a pastor, right? Like, you're okay with that, because that is going to require something from you. It is. And you know, that doesn't mean you need to be the worship leader and the biggest extrovert on planet Earth. Like, I'm not asking you to be something that you're not. And the church that we'll go to won't ask you to be something that you're not. But there is something that comes with that. And, you know, I remember the second time we dated specifically, I had to reintroduce that conversation. Like, are you still okay with this? And we were on a hike and, you know, she said, I've never envisioned myself doing this or marrying a pastor, but I love you, and if it means being with you, then that's what it means. And so that was the best answer that I could have gotten, you know, not her faking like, you know, yeah, you know, I'm all about this, I want to do this, I've thought about this for a while, but for her just to be like, no, like, I love you, and if that's what it means, then let's make this happen. So, yeah. And one more thing, too. I always joke with her, because we have a good family friend who's the chaplain of the Carolina Hurricanes, which is an NHL professional team. So I'm always like, why didn't you tap into that? Like, you could have married a guy making like $7 million a year. And, you know, and he loves the Lord and he's a professional athlete. And she always goes, don't even joke about that. I'm like, I'm sorry.
Can you tell them just a little bit about your daughters, and also, if you don't mind, the story of Claire and that miracle story?
Yeah, you know, so we have two daughters. Olivia is 2, and Claire is about 8 months old, and so I always thought that I'd be a father of sons. That's just kind of both of our families. That's where we come from. My dad is the youngest of 5 boys. On Abby's dad's side, she was the first girl born in over 100 years. And then, yeah, and then on her mom's side, her mom's from a big Italian Catholic family. They've got 7, and 5 of the 7 are boys. So it's just kind of like, we're going to have a little flock of rascals here. And yet the Lord has given us girls. And recently I preached through Ruth in our young adults ministry, and I love that passage in Ruth 4 where they look at Naomi and they say, you know, blessed are you for your daughter who is worth more to you than 7 sons. And I love that, because I'm like, yeah, these little girls, especially when I see other little boys like breaking things, I'm like, you're worth more to me than 7 sons. And then when we had Claire, there was a lot of concern. I'm still not quite sure, looking back on it, what to make of it, quite honestly. But there was a lot of concern, depending on what doctor we looked at, saying that she was in the first or second percentile in head size, in tummy size, and all that kind of stuff. They basically kind of read us all the terrible possibilities, which I know you have to do legally. But as a husband, I'm sitting there watching this doctor like read this stuff to my wife, like, what are you doing? Like, why would you do this? And we had a lot of people praying, and we had to induce a few weeks early, and Claire was born 6 pounds, 2 ounces. So what happened to that 1%, you know, first percentile stuff? And looking back on it, I'm honestly not quite sure what to make of it. Did the Lord do something wonderful and miraculous there? Or are the doctors freaking out my wife for no reason? And maybe there's a combination of both. And but yeah, as you guys know, as moms, it's like I'm not quite sure what to take seriously or not, but I'm going to do the best thing I need to do for my kids. So yeah,
that was right after you guys kind of arrived here, so everybody was concerned and praying, and then it just worked out so beautifully.
Yeah, and then there's also the like personally. And this is bad, but I'll just be honest with you anyways. There's the personal kind of embarrassment of asking people to pray for you. Like, this is a serious issue, and then your kid comes out totally fine. And you're like, okay, well, you know. So, yeah.
That effort.
Yeah, right. Sorry for you fasting, you know, and removing food, you know, for me. We're totally fine.
David had mentioned a couple things that were on his heart, so I thought I would ask him one of the questions he gave me, and then we'll open it up and see if you all have any questions for him. But one thing he wanted that was on his heart was talking about what is the biblical view of children, and how does that inform your parenting? And it's something that he had been just personally just kind of looking into.
Yeah, this has been really impactful for me recently because as a dad and as a dad on kind of the newer side of things, so I'm at the very end of the millennial generation, and looking at the way that millennials and Gen Zers specifically view parenting and children is quite interesting. So I can't count the number of my friends who I went to high school with, even some Christian friends who have a Christian higher education degree, who are saying no to children for a variety of reasons, whether it's climate concerns, whether it's why would I bring a child into this crazy messed up world, whether it's personal autonomy and why would I do that to my body, especially as a woman, look, I'm just going to have a career and live with a partner and be happy. Like, I don't want anything to do with children. I've got multiple cousins who I had a large family of extended cousins, and there's very few children from that generation that I'm from. Part of it's because my extended family is filled with a lot of divorces. And so there's people that are like, I'm not getting married and I'm not having kids, you know, that sort of deal. And without trying to be too hard on those people, I've been very deeply impacted in my own scripture reading of, like, the way that I see our culture view children purely as a burden or a commodity to have whether or not you want it. And for y'all as mothers, it can be easy for us even to fall into that category sometimes. Especially when our kids are like going nuts over and over and over again. You're like, good night. But, you know, even looking at a passage like Genesis 1 and thinking, what is one of the first commandments that the Lord gives us? It's to be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, bring dominion over the earth. How do we do that, number one? People talk all the time about how Genesis 1 applies to the workplace or to philanthropic efforts or whatever it might be. But that's, and I'm not saying those aren't a part of that, but the fundamental command there is to bear children and to raise them. And you can't get around that when you read that passage. Does that mean that every woman is called to bear children? No, there's going to be infertility. There's going to be women who live a life of singleness, kind of like a Pauline life or, you know, whatever it might be. But collectively, we are to bear and raise children. And that's the primary way that we fulfill this command to be fruitful and multiply. And then I was preaching through the Psalms of Ascent, and you get to Psalm 127. Psalm 127:1 is the famous verse of, unless the Lord builds the house, they who labor build it in vain. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. And then you get to verse 3, and verse 3 is one of the most powerful verses for parenting, I think, out there. And it's, behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. And that verse has been ringing on my brain for probably the last 3 months right now, because it is even countercultural for us as Christians right now to raise godly families and to view children as a reward, as a fruit, as something that is not just good because we chose it to be good, because that's what we wanted in our own autonomous lives, but it is good in and of itself. And it's a powerful thing. And what you're doing as moms and the way that you are sacrificing for your children, you know, you may see your friends who decided never to get married and have kids on their social media, and they're going to Barbados like every other weekend, and they're taking like 4 Orange Theory classes a day. And I'm, you know, and again, I'm my intention is not to judge that person, but my intention is to say that what we're doing is fundamentally wonderful and good in parenting and in raising kids. And as the world continues to devalue the worth of children, our own parental efforts are going to be an evangelistic witness to the world in and of themselves. And so there's plenty of other verses that talk about the value of children, and plenty of other reflections, but that's just been encouraging for my heart, and I hope it's encouraging for yours too.
Awesome. I want to ask now if anyone has any questions for David on marriage or parenting or RBC, whatever. Lacey, you look like you were going to say something.
Call her out.
I know. I'm good at that.
Christine.
You know what?
It's just that it won't be on the recording.
I can always repeat it.
Oh, okay. David will repeat it. Okay.
Yeah.
Given where you are in young adults, right? So everybody's the parents of a little kid here, primarily. And you got to keep your eye on the ball, the little kid. You also kind of have to keep your eye on the ahead, because without a vision, the people perish. What's one of the biggest challenges you see in the young adults now, faith-wise? What is something that you see these young adults, what is their biggest challenge related to their faith? And what would you advise for people who are with little kids in terms of being present and paying attention to what has to happen now, but equally keeping your eye on the long run?
Those are great questions. The questions for anyone watching online was, number one, what am I seeing kind of in regards to marriage and parenting and kind of the young adults world? I oversee kind of young professionals. And then the second question was, how do we kind of love our kids well in the middle of what they're doing the second, but also kind of keep our eye on the long-term vision? So regarding the first one, I preached a full sermon on the blessing of children to a bunch of single young adults a couple months ago. And it was like, this is a risk. And it actually went over really well. And I've had some great conversations with people. And very interestingly enough, if you looked at, and I'm not like an expert in this subject, but if you looked at economists and kind of your cultural philosophers some decades ago, the big concern was population. Right? We're overpopulating the earth, and it's irresponsible for you to bring a child into the world because we are draining the resources of this earth, which, while maybe is based on some level of truth, if I can be just totally blunt, that's a despicable thing to believe, that it is irresponsible to bring a child into this world and to view someone as irresponsible for doing that. And that's a technical term. But what you're starting to see even from non-Christian and even secular sources is actually there's a population concern right now. It's actually flipping. It's the exact opposite, particularly in the United States, where we have all these boomers that are retiring and who are going to go on Social Security, and there's and millennials and Gen Zs are not having as many kids as going to be needed to sustain the boomers in retirement. And so I don't know how all that's going to work out. Like, I'm not an economist or anything like that, but I think it's very interesting that even if you're just focusing on practical economic concerns, even some of the younger generations, millennials and Gen Zers, are starting to be like, we were told from people that bringing children to the world is irresponsible for economic reasons. And actually, the chickens are coming home to roost on that one. And so I've had conversations about that with people. But I think also one of the things that I was challenging my young adults, and I think that they're starting to think through, is what does it look like for me to cultivate children as a single person, to volunteer in Quest, to care for children with disabilities, maybe even one day to consider with their spouse fostering an adoption. Especially for my young adults who are very career-focused, as we're in Northern Virginia, and just because of our generation to begin with, that's a pretty radical shift in their mind. So there's a lot more to be said there, but those are some of the things that I'm seeing is even an eye-opening thing of maybe not having kids isn't profitable for society. When it comes to stuff right now and stuff in the future, I've noticed that this is where Abby and I make a really good team, because Abby is so detail-oriented and such a wonderful nurturer that she's just, I mean, she's taking care of all the stuff that's going on right now. You know, from packing to go on vacation, we just went to the Outer Banks last week, packing, go on vacation, making sure doctor's appointments are set, all this kind of stuff that I'm like, I don't know how you juggle all these logistics. And I think there's probably a mom element in there. It's not just me as an individual and her as an individual. There's probably like a mom element in there too. But one thing that I think I bring to the table, and I think a lot of husbands and fathers bring to the table, is I can keep my eye on the prize. And I think for me, I can't find the ketchup in the fridge, but I actually do pretty often think about what it's going to be like to educate our own children as Olivia hits school age, where Abby might be so wrapped up in what we've got to do today that I kind of am able to like take her out and be like, we need to start a financial account for this. We need to start visiting schools this year. We need, you know, whatever it might be. And then meanwhile, you know, if the kids are with me, they're butt naked running around, and Abby's like, why didn't you clothe them? I'm like, that's a really good point, you know. So maybe your situation, and if you're a single parent too, like, I don't want to say that it's going to be impossible for you. It's not going to be impossible for you. Like, you are going to be able to do it with a good community around you. But I think this is where, for those of you who are married, and you and your husband are raising your kids together, this is going to be something that you're going to have to tag team on. Because especially if you stay at home, like, you are in the thick of it. Like, you are on the front lines in a fight. And what you need is a general behind you who may not be as much in the fight with you, and you shouldn't despise him for that, but who, because he's not as much in the fight with you, he's actually got a pretty good image of the battlefield. And he can be able to direct you guys as a family what you need to do and where you need to go. And yes, you're going to get frustrated with him because he can't find the keys and he keeps all the cabinets open and he asks stupid questions all the time. And I do all those things all the time. I think you have to, and it's going to be really challenging, but you have to, in your day-to-day parenting, keep the fact that this kid isn't going to be this age forever. And for me as a toddler, it's like, yeah, Olivia just wants to do something else while I read her Jesus Storybook Bible or whatever it might be, but I'm planting seeds here. And I've got to trust that as we're planting seeds, that the Lord is going to provide the increase at some point. So I'm still learning, but I do know that when Abby and I are working as a team, I think it does work out pretty well in terms of parenting and vision for the future.
Awesome. Anybody else have a question? Any other questions?
I'm hesitant in answering this question because it's online and it's recorded. But okay, and I want to go to a place because I think it's important, and I don't mean to do this in sort of like a grotesque or like flippant way. Yeah, the question is, and it's a wonderful question. You know, for those of you who are new moms who have a baby who are kind of occupied with your young kids, like, what does it look like to keep your relationship with your husband strong? Am I kind of summarizing that well? Okay. Few things. And I'll start with me. And this is something that, don't beat your husband over the head with this, but, like, he's going to have to learn is, this is going to be kind of embarrassing to say, but I can almost guarantee your husband is thinking this. Your husband has to learn to serve you without wanting sex. It's just, it's going to be, like, he's got to do that. Sorry, that was really embarrassing to say, but it's like, honestly, like, it's true. So we'll just leave that there. He's going to have to do that, here's a few ways that I felt really loved by Abby. When I get home from work, I really love when she acknowledges me before handing me the kids. And it doesn't always happen, and I've just got to deal with it and go into dad mode quickly. You know, however your structure looks like, for me, we've got Abby staying home right now, just with the two little kids. Now, many of you might work, and so there's not going to be this, like, 5:30 handoff every day. It might work a little bit different for you in your home. I really want to feel loved and respected by my wife, still as her husband. I'm still your guy. You know, and I still crave you looking at me like, that's my guy right there. And for you, even if you're like kind of faking it, for you to still do that and let him know, like, you're still my guy. Like, these kids, they've got me, they've got 99% of me, but the best 1% is what I can give you, you know, and I haven't forgot about you. And I still think that you're the coolest guy ever, whatever it might be. I think that's going to be really important. He's going to have a certain love language. He's going to have certain things that he likes. But I think being able to give him just some like undivided emotional attention, and not to just. Maybe if I'm going to summarize it in one sentence, it's not to just see him as a co-parent, but to see him as your husband and your closest friend and the man in the house who deserves your love and admiration and respect. And if he knows that you feel that way about him, watch how many diapers he's going to change, you know. So that's a little short/long answer.
Any other questions? I have one other one that we talked about that I think would be beneficial for a lot of us is relationships with in-laws or just complicated family relationships. What are some suggestions on how to biblically and lovingly navigate those?
Yeah, and this is such a good one, and I'm sure most of us have some sort of thing here. And if you've seen one weird family dynamic, you've seen one weird family dynamic, because every one has its own unique sort of like just oddities. But let me kind of paint a picture of our situation and how we're ongoingly seeking to handle it. So this week is a big weekend in our family, and in Abby's family specifically. This is recorded. Big weekend. Okay, so long story short, Abby's got an older brother. His older brother and his family has distanced themselves from my in-laws for reasons that I won't go into. But there's a pretty significant divide going on right now. And it's a divide that's lasted basically since we got married. Like, stuff went down at our wedding that we didn't know about. Thankfully, we didn't know about. We were in blissful ignorance. We had no idea. And this weekend, on Sunday, is going to be the first time in 2.5 years that my brother-in-law and his family see my in-laws here. And so we felt kind of caught in the middle in some difficult situations. And the mistake that we made at the beginning of all of this going down was like, we can fix this. And it was more of my mistake, honestly, because I'm like over the top black and white sometimes. And I'm like, look, if you just stop being an idiot here and you stop being an idiot here, then we can like figure this thing out. And it was honestly a really good pastoral lesson for me, because I actually don't have as much control over people as I would sometimes like to have. And so for about the first like 6 to 8 months, like we really tried. We're like, hey, we'll set up big family meetings with counselors. Like, we'll do this, we'll do that. You know, we'll figure it out here. And it just, none of it worked. And it didn't just not work. It fell flat on its face. And what Abby and I have had to learn is we're not going to be a mediator. We're not going to be the middleman. I'm carrying your message to this person or vice versa. But we're learning that, number one, like, we're going to do what's best for our family and the health of our family and the health of our children. And we are not going to jump ship. We are going to, and it's going to be with some guardrails and some boundaries and whatever it might be. But we are going to honor my in-laws. And we are going to respect them, even when it's frustrating. And I haven't done a perfect job at that, but like we're really attempting to try to do that. And I will say this: one of the reasons that Abby and I broke up, there was a myriad of reasons, but one of them was because Abby really hadn't personally differentiated herself from her family. And that was tough, because I came into the picture, and the more I got in the picture,
the more of a threat I.
And so when all that went down, and then when we got back together, I had two questions for Abby that I needed to figure out when we got back together. The first was, where are you planning on living? Because I'm not doing long distance with you again. It destroyed us. And the second was, what is your relationship with your family like right now? Specifically, and what Abby had done in those 2 years was she began the long process of differentiating herself and establishing herself as a independent woman. And what has been so nice for our family is that I trust her 100% because she's gone through that hard process. And I trust that I'm not going to be the one that's having to build the fence posts all the time, because I don't want to do that all the time. Like, I'm happy to do that when that's needed, but so my encouragement to you all is continue to honor your parents, continue to honor your in-laws, but your husband and your family is going to be that much more benefited when you are kind of your own woman and you're not bought into a family system that that lets tornadoes run loose through your home, that cowtails to the every whim of a certain family member, whether that's an estranged sibling or a parent or whatever it might be. Because oftentimes in those family dynamics, there's one or two people at the center and everyone's kind of doing this around them, right? And at some point you've got to like jump out of that funnel, and you've got to do that not in an aggressive way, but you've got to do that in a clear way. And when you do that, it's just going to benefit your family exponentially. And frankly, I think one of the reasons why the stuff has gone down with Abby's side of the family is because that wasn't done early on. So that would just be my encouragement to you. That might sound like kind of vague, but I hope that somewhat applies to your situation.
Did that spark any questions? I don't want to overlook anyone that might have a question. I've got one. I think we have time for one more. Yeah.
That's the wisdom you get by being a Lutheran right there.
Yeah, one of the hardest things for me was when my son got married, and he married my best friend's daughter, and they moved to California, and her mom and I both live here. And I think that was the best thing that could have happened, because we were so close and they had kind of grown up together, and they moved to California. And we both, moms, had to let go, and we didn't want to, but I think it was the best thing that could have happened. So, yeah, exactly what you're saying, Kelly. You really have to intentionally let them go, and you don't want to. Anybody else have a question for David? The very last one I'm going to ask you, this will be our last one, is I'm torn between, we've got two choices here, but parenting fails is the one you mentioned to me, and that might be a good one to wrap up on. Did you have something in mind that you had failed at?
Well, yeah, I mean, parenting is failing over and over and over again, and learning some resilience when you do fail. So, you know, I think that's been one of the hardest things for me to get used to, is like, I like to think that Abby and I are decent parents, but like, we're going to screw this up basically every day. something is not going to go our way. And these kids aren't robots. Like, I can't just program them on a schedule. And, you know, I mean, when they're that age, I mean, you can. But even that age, they're already starting to be like, no, I'm going to cry right now. So I'll give you a couple funny ones. Both of them happened this summer. So we are in our apartment pool. It's the end of the summer, and we've been potty training Olivia, and we're like, we're gonna take this next step, and we're not gonna put a swim diaper on. And it's like 5:30. It's like just as the evening started. Saturday night, all these families in our apartment complex, like, that's their night to like be together and have fun at the pool. And Olivia drops a load in the pool. And so we you know, we're like scrambling, right? Because I look down and you see it start floating, and so we're like, Abby and I are immediately just like embarrassed, frustrated, angry, and so we're like talking to the lifeguard. The lifeguard's like, "What?" He's like, doesn't speak great English, so like we're having to repeat it, like, sheep pooped in the pool. And so the whole pool was shut down the whole night. They had to drain the whole pool, ruin the night for so many families in our apartment complex. And but the fail really happened, if that wasn't a fail enough. The fail really happened when we were walking back to our apartment and subsequently giving her a bath, and that we said bad girl a few times, and she knew better. I mean, there's not like full innocence there. Like, she knew better, you know. She's at that point where this wasn't just like a whoopsie daisy. This was a decision. But ever since then, Olivia repeats bad girl all the time, and most of the time she calls Abby bad girl, but which leads to some timeouts. But when she is losing it and she's in one of her terrible two tantrums, she'll do something she knows is wrong and then through tears call herself bad girl. And it's like, we did that. We reaped that. And we are in the process of undoing that right now, of saying, Olivia, don't say that. You made a bad decision. But we love you, and you're not a bad girl. So that's like one of those ones that just in a moment of frustration, we said something, and that is coming back to bite us right now. I'll give another funny one, too, just because that one ended up being very, very serious. We were in our apartment complex, and we're trying to, like, get to know our neighbors and talk to our neighbors. And so there's this one woman who we're talking to, and actually both of these have to do with Olivia going to the bathroom. She's actually pretty good, if I can defend my toddler. She's actually pretty good about going to the bathroom in the potty. But she was playing, and she had just, like, peed herself. So we had done the whole thing where you change it, you put it in a bag. And we didn't, like, put it back in the backpack. We put it in the stroller in the bottom. And so while Abby and I, we get back to the apartment, while Abby and I are talking to this woman, Olivia takes out, well, behind our backs, she takes out this soggy pee-pee underwear and just throws it. And it goes right by this woman's face. I mean, it almost like hit her in the mouth. And it just goes right by her face, hits the wall behind her, and like falls to the floor. And we're like scrambling, like trying to pretend like nothing happened. You're like, oh, yeah, totally, you know. Where'd you say you're from? And like quickly put it like back in the bag and like back in the thing. So that was something pretty funny that happened to us pretty recently. So, yeah.
I think that's, thank you, David, so much. Thank you so much. That was amazing. Lots of wisdom there, lots to think about. Ladies, at your, you know, actually, before I let you talk, I just want to pray real quickly for Abby.
She really wanted to be with you guys, by the way. She's flu. She's in the flu right now. Yeah. So, but if you don't know her, she's wonderful. You should get to know her.